Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. There is so much to talk about as we head into another tumultuous week. China being blindsided by the deadly coronavirus, new tapes and new revelations in the impeachment story as the president's defense lawyers continue to make their case before the Senate. And in Los Angeles, Lakers fans are in shock and mourning. Actually, make that basketball fans across the nation and the world at the death of NBA legend Kobe Bryant. So this hour On Point, what to look for in the week ahead. And let's start right away with the ongoing reaction to the death of Kobe Bryant. And joining me now in the studio is Shira Springer. She's sports and society reporter for WBUR. She also covered the NBA for a decade as well and is a columnist on women's sports. Shira, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, you knew Kobe. You covered him for a long time. What was your first reaction when this terrible news came yesterday?
Absolute shock and disbelief. I mean, still part of it is disbelief. And it's interesting because the more I talk about it, the more difficult it gets because the more real it becomes. But still, there is still a part of me that says this simply can't be true.
Right. And he died along with his daughter in a helicopter crash. We won't talk about any details surrounding the actual crash itself because that reporting needs to be done accurately. But tell us a little bit about how the world of basketball is responding to this.
Reeling, absolutely reeling from what happened and the shock and the suddenness of it. I think one of the things that was most moving is if you watch some of the NBA games last night, and there were many people who thought those NBA games shouldn't be played in memory of Kobe. But then there was the segment that said, well, Kobe, the consummate competitor, would have wanted players to play. But what you saw was a lot of players teary-eyed, holding back tears. Some were crying. And what teams did as a tribute is they took 24-second shot clock violations because, of course, Kobe was number 24 for part of his career. Also, later after the games, Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban announced that his team, the Mavericks, would be retiring the number 24, that no player would wear it in the future. So I think it speaks to the fact that not only was Kobe beloved in L.A. as a Lakers player, but there was such respect for what he meant to the NBA game. He was, for many of the players of today, their Michael Jordan.
Wow. And so across the nation, then, this sort of, like you said, reeling shock. But also particularly right now in Los Angeles, right? I mean, people gathering outside the Staples Center.
Yeah, it was a strange scene last night because in the house that Kobe built, the Staples Center, you had the Grammys going on. So you had these, you know, ball gown dressed music stars mixing with crowds who were there to pay tribute to Kobe because that's the place you would go to pay tribute to Kobe. I mean, he was there. He spent his entire 20-year career there. He was an 18-time All-Star, 5 championships. I mean, this is a guy who in his first year of eligibility, which happens to be this year, will be obviously a Hall of Famer, and he redefined the game.
So those numbers say so much.
Yes.
But tell us more about, I mean, you covered the NBA for a decade, you saw him play in any number of games. What is it that Kobe Bryant did on the court, did for basketball, that so captured the imaginations and passions of so many fans?
Yeah, I was trying to figure out this morning how many games I'd actually watched Kobe live in, had the opportunity to watch him play live. And that number is up around 60, 70 games. And I think what I remember most is not so much what he did and how he played, but the anticipation, the expectation that whenever you were watching a game that Kobe was going to play in, something special might happen. We know he scored 81 points in one game. There was a stretch where he scored 40 or more points. I think it was in 9 games straight, and then 50 or more points in 4 games straight. These were all Michael Jordan-like numbers, close to Wilt Chamberlain numbers in the 81-point case. But I think, you know, the mark of a truly great athlete, you know, an iconic athlete, is that you come to the arena and the expectation is that you are going to witness something extraordinary, or that there's the potential to witness something extraordinary. And that was always the case when you went to a game where Kobe was playing.
Well, I just want to hear a little tape of Kobe Bryant himself talking about his relationship with basketball, how he felt about the sport. So this is from 2015 when he had written a poem announcing his retirement, I believe, from the sport. It's called Dear Basketball. And the poem was made into an animated short that won an Oscar. And here's a moment from that short and Kobe Bryant speaking.
From the moment I started rolling my dad's tube socks and shooting imaginary game-winning shots in the Great Western Forum, I knew one thing was real. I fell in love with you. A love so deep, I gave you my all. From my mind and body to my spirit and soul.
Kobe Bryant in 2015 from an animated short about his poem titled Dear Basketball. So what did this sport mean to him?
It was everything. I mean, it was absolutely everything for the period that he was playing. And I think what you also hear in his reading of that poem is just how deep a thinker he was. This wasn't just somebody who played basketball because he loved the game or fell in love with the game. He thought very consciously about what the game meant to him. And that's what struck you when you talked to him. I had the opportunity to talk to him one-on-one more than a handful of times. And, you know, long conversations. And, you know, I would say maybe half the conversation was about basketball. And then we'd go off onto some unexpected topic. It could be, you know, places he traveled, languages he wanted to learn, the state of European soccer. Sometimes it was women's sports. You know, there was no topic that was off limit. And his curiosity about things was boundless. Mm. And that really struck you when you talked to him.
So let's talk about his relationship with his daughter, who also died in this helicopter crash, and his support for the women's game as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously all of this is tough, but that's one of the toughest parts, knowing that he died with his daughter, who was sort of like a mini-me, had become a mini-me. She was as passionate about basketball as he was, and in fact had sort of drawn him back into the NBA game with her passion. He, you know, after he retired, he was off doing other things, but she really wanted to study the game. She wanted to eventually play for the UConn women's program and then go on to play for the WNBA. And one of the videos that keeps surfacing that's so difficult to watch, but also touching at the same time, is Kobe and his daughter Gianna sitting on the sidelines, floor seats at an NBA game. I think it was Nets, Atlanta Hawks. So they hadn't, it wasn't in LA. And they were just talking, and you could tell they were talking about strategy. And he's explaining the game to her, and she's looking at him, and just both of them are smiling. And the pride that you see in his face and the love that you see in her face is, you know, it touches your heart. And then, you know, also when you watched her, she was a star in the making. I mean, I think there's a consensus about that, not just saying that because it was Kobe's daughter.
Well, so this is how Kobe Bryant himself talked about his daughter Gianna's love of basketball and how much it meant to him as well, because there's a clip that's also been making the rounds over the past couple of hours of Kobe Bryant on Jimmy Kimmel Live back in 2018, and here it is.
Do you think your daughter might want to play in the WNBA?
She does, for sure.
She does?
Like, I mean, this kid, man.
Wouldn't that be great?
Dude, man, I'm telling you. The best thing that happens is when we go out and fans will come up to me and she'll be standing next to me and they'll be like,
hey, you gotta have a boy. You and V gotta have a boy, man. You have somebody carry on the tradition, the legacy. She's like, oh, I got this. You know, boy, for that, I got this.
Yeah. What do you hear in that?
Father's pride, absolute pride. It's a wonderful moment, and she had the, you know, and it's also the recognition, game recognizing game. He knew she had a special talent, and he was nurturing it, and just the pride, the absolute pride in that.
So, what did his support for women players and for the women's game mean to like the WNBA?
Oh, it was tremendous, because obviously, you know, one of the big hurdles with women's sports is to get people to pay attention, to value the quality of the play. And to have Kobe Bryant sitting on the sidelines and supporting the games, knowing that, you know, saying that these are great players. And in fact, recently he had said that some of the WNBA players could play in the NBA right now. And to have that, it's not that women need that seal of approval, and I don't want to call it a seal of approval. Mm-hmm. But that awareness raising, that respect to coming from Kobe Bryant meant everything. It's why you're hearing so many testimonies and memorial tweets coming from WNBA players, even the commissioner of the WNBA.
Right. Let's just spend a second talking about Kobe Bryant's complex legacy off the court as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you're alluding to is what happened in 2003 with the sexual assault charges. And listen, I was a reporter who was there in Eagle, Colorado, covering those legal proceedings. And to this day, it is somewhat tough to reconcile that moment, that part of Kobe's personal history off the court, and what he was becoming in this advocate for women's sports. And I will say this. He was a complicated person. We're all complicated people. And it will be part of his complicated legacy.
And ultimately, the reaction to Bryant's death I don't even know how, like volcanic almost,
yeah,
yesterday.
It was a real gut punch. You felt it.
What do people feel like they've lost here?
They've lost an icon. For many players in the NBA, they've lost not only an icon but a mentor. I mean, I think that was something that was coming across too, is how many players currently in the NBA that Kobe had reached out to, that had supported either through injuries or had practiced with. So I think it's an icon. It's somebody, you know, and it's also the future, right? You're losing the future, because he was 41 and there was this sense that he was coming into his own with his second act. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a sense of also limitless possibility given the drive that he showed in his career. We all wanted to see what he would do next, and now we don't get that opportunity.
And the possibility in his daughter
exactly,
as well.
Exactly.
Well, Shira Springer, sports and society reporter for WBUR. She covered the NBA for a decade and is also a columnist on women's sports as well. Thank you, Shira.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll swing over to the other coast and talk about impeachment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what to look for in yet another big week in the news ahead. And now let's dig in on the latest on the impeachment trial going on in the Senate, the impeachment of President Trump. And we want to hear from you. We're going to talk about revelations, reported revelations from John Bolton's book, a new tape of the president speaking about the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, the president's defense team and their opening arguments that we heard in the past couple of days. Well, I'm joined now by Anita Kumar. She's with us from Washington. She's White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. Anita, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back, Anita. Also with us from Washington as well is Lisa Desjardins. She's a correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. She covers the Capitol. And Lisa, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
Okay. Where are you right now, Lisa, by the way?
I am almost at the U.S. Capitol, so I'll be walking in. We're having sort of daily news conferences that I'll be heading to shortly.
Okay, so if you hear Lisa running around, that's literally because she's running towards the news. Okay, so Anita, let me just start with you here to give Lisa a second to make her way into the building. Let's talk about the report over the weekend, first in the New York Times, about former NSA advisor, National Security Advisor John Bolton, and revelations in his book. So what has happened with John Bolton?
Yeah, this has really taken off overnight. So, John Bolton has mentioned that he is going to be writing a book, and he's talked about that before. What the New York Times first reported and others reported after was that the book indicates in there that John Bolton is saying that he had a conversation with President Trump about basically a quid pro quo, saying the president wanted to withhold aid to Ukraine until he got the investigations he wanted about the Bidens. So why this is so important is that, you know, the House, when they did their first investigation or their investigation last year, they didn't get to hear from John Bolton or Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, or other people that are directly talking to the president that are very close advisors. You know, the White House prevented those people from testifying. So John Bolton is putting this in a book and saying, and he's previously said he's open to testifying to the Senate. So we've seen some people overnight and this morning, some people indicating that this, you know, really puts a lot of pressure now on Senate Republicans to say that there shouldn't be any testimony. And you saw Senator Mitt Romney, who's a moderate Republican, who's been sort of on the fence about witnesses, kind of saying this might move people towards saying there should be witnesses. So, you know, that decision is probably going to come up later this week. Should there be witnesses in this Senate trial or not?
Mm. Now, Lisa, John Bolton did not testify before the House because the White House blocked him from doing so. There were a lot of critics of Bolton during the House's investigations who said, well, he shouldn't have honored the White House's wishes and just done it anyway. But now do we have is this Bolton trying to sell books, or does he really want to actually talk?
Well, the New York Times story points out, and others have pointed out as well, that the reason Bolton wants to speak now is because he doesn't want to be accused later. This is from their sources. He doesn't want to be accused later of only trying to sell his book. That he wants to be seen as someone who does want to get his information out in the time of a very large question about the president. You know, one other thing that I think we will hear about today, probably from Republicans, is that while it's true Bolton was blocked from testifying by order of the president to the House, that was only under the House request. The House did not subpoena Mr. Bolton. They made that decision. And they made that decision because Bolton said he would wait for a court to rule on any subpoena. And the House made the calculation that that would take too long. But the House, it was a decision by the House not to subpoena him. And the House certainly could have done that, but decided not to.
So, Anita, just first of all, before we get into sort of speculation on what might happen in the course of the remainder of the week, has the White House responded to the revelations from yesterday?
Sure. A couple different things. Well, we saw the president tweet. Of course, he is saying that, you know, he's disparaging John Bolton. He's reminding everybody that the two left on, you know, bad terms, basically, that the president's saying he was fired. John Bolton would dispute that. But nevertheless, he left the White House not on good terms. You know, they're saying this isn't true. That the president never had that conversation. You know, interestingly, the national security team over there at the White House, which is part of the White House, is saying, yes, we knew about this. We got a copy of the book. We, you know, they have to look at the book and look at things in there to see if there's any, they're going to have any objections. But what they're saying is that no one else in the White House knew about this. It's a very interesting, sounds like a little, you know, little point here, but it's actually a very big point. The question is, did the president and did his top aides know that this was going to come out or that John Bolton was saying this and then try to stop witnesses? So, you know, there's a lot of people saying, well, look, the White House knew, that's why they don't want witnesses in this trial.
Wow. And so we're seeing reports that some Republican senators, unnamed as of yet, have called the White House kind of in a fit of pique, trying to figure out who in the administration knew this was going to happen. And maybe they're feeling blindsided there. On the other side of the aisle, here's Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar and presidential candidate responding to what the legal defense that the president has begun, his team has begun to present. And she was on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, insisting that new evidence must be admitted in the trial.
I don't know how they can cut out facts and evidence. And then as I heard my colleague just say on your show, and then he says, well, it's circumstantial. Well, come on, let's get to the Founding Fathers musical, Hamilton, and talk about the people who were in the room where it happened. Right. That would be Bolton. That will be Mulvaney. They have the facts. They were there. And no matter how they vote on impeachment in the end, Americans want a fair trial. The polls show overwhelmingly people want to hear from the witnesses.
That's it. Senator Amy Klobuchar on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, referring to the room where it happened. And in the crazy funhouse mirror of Washington politics, Lisa, I believe that is actually the name of John Bolton's book, right? The Room Where It Happened.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's smart. It's a smart pop title.
But let me ask you, Lisa, I mean, Anita had mentioned this before. Do you think that what Bolton might have to say is weighty enough to convince that critical mass of Republican senators to change their mind on allowing witnesses in the Senate trial? Mm.
That is the main question here. We already know there is one Senator, Susan Collins, who has said she was likely to want witnesses. Mitt Romney has also indicated he was interested in witnesses. Lisa Murkowski had been very warm to the idea of witnesses, but sort of pushed back after Adam gave his closing remarks last Democrats case. But she has been open to the idea. And then there are probably a handful of other Republicans we're watching closely. I think that people reporting that four Republicans need to side with Democrats in order to call. I see it a little differently. I think that no one wants to be that deciding vote. No one wants to be the fourth Republican to vote for witnesses. And so I think what would have to happen is you'd have to have at least two or three additional Republicans as a group say, we want witnesses. And something like this news about John Bolton gives them that ability, that cover. Here's my reason. Here's why I'm saying this, for breaking with the president on this and from breaking with Mitch McConnell on this question. I think it's possible. I don't have a read yet. And I don't think we will know for a few hours of exactly how big of a momentum shift this is or not.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. David's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. David, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. It seems clear to me that John Bolton has something to say. So why doesn't he just release a public statement or go on TV like Parnas did? Because he would have infinitely more credibility about the same subject matter.
Yeah, David, that's a really interesting question. And thank you for your call. Anita Kumar, do you think that that could possibly happen?
It's a great question. And I've seen a lot of people overnight saying, why doesn't he just do that? He can come out and give a statement. Now, obviously, that's not in a trial. It's not giving, you know, testimony in a trial. But if he has something to say, he could say it. And there's a lot of people in Washington today saying he's not going to do that because he's trying to sell his book. He could have done that this entire time, right? If he had something to say all these very many months, he could have come out and said that. So, you know, he could still do that. It's a little bit, you know, as Lisa said, it's a little unclear now what's going to happen, how senators are feeling about it and how much pressure he feels.
Is it possible possible that if there doesn't seem to be sufficient movement in the Senate regarding witnesses, that Democratic leaders in the House could actually finally just issue that subpoena to Bolton and have him appear before a House committee?
Well, I guess they could do that. But remember, this piece, this you know, the House impeachment inquiry has moved on. I mean, right. They have voted already and it's gone to the Senate. So if they want to include that in the Senate trial, that would be the place for them to do it. But sure, they're going to continue investigating the president in other ways. Because remember, let's remember that we believe that the president would be acquitted. There are not the votes to, remove him from office. House Democrats have said they're going to continue to investigate him in a variety of ways, not just, you know, not looking past Ukraine, on a whole host of things that they want to look at. So it's possible they could totally do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of whether we actually end up seeing witnesses in the Senate trial here, one can't imagine, or one wonders if Republicans would call witnesses as well, right? I mean, we see Senator Lindsey Graham warning that if Democrats insist on having witnesses in this trial, that Republicans would call Hunter Biden, for example. So that's also part of the story. But Lisa, let me just focus for a second on the fact of what John Bolton is alleging to have said or have written in his book, that the president basically directly tied that aid to Ukraine to his request or demand or desire for an investigation into the Bidens, and that Bolton is saying he has firsthand knowledge of this. How does that have an impact on the defense that the president's team is currently laying out in the Senate trial?
That's a great question. And the defense so far has been primarily, we've only had a couple hours of the defense from Saturday. Today is really the big day. But the defense so far has laid out the concept that the president was acting, these are the exact words of the attorneys on Saturday, acting in the national interest, not in his own interest, and that he was, in fact, concerned about corruption writ large in Ukraine, not just about these specific investigations. You know, they have made the argument that these investigations are part of that. They're not denying that the president wanted these specific investigations, but they're saying this was part of a larger goal by the president in which he was thinking of the country and not himself. So if, in fact, the president was withholding aid specifically because of these two investigations, which do have personal meaning for the president, then that's a very big problem for the defense. But then, of course, it comes down, as in any trial, who do you believe? The president on Twitter is denying that he ever said these things to John Bolton. And then if we are able to hear from John Bolton, senators would have to assess how credible he is or not. Many of these senators have worked with John Bolton, Republicans especially, for a long time. They know him. And my understanding from talking to several of them about him for months is that they do believe, whatever else you think of John Bolton and his ideas, they believe that he's a man of integrity. Hmm. So that is something in his favor right now. But, you know, it remains to be seen how this all plays out. Having a book come out is something that senators are thinking about as well.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what the president's defense team did say before the Senate on Saturday. Here's Pat Cipollone saying that in his view and in the president's view, there's simply no case against him.
We don't believe that they have come anywhere close to meeting their burden for what they're asking you to do. In fact, we believe that when you hear the facts, and that's what we intend to cover today, the facts, you will find that the president did absolutely nothing wrong.
That's one of the president's defense team, Pat Cipollone, on Saturday in front of the Senate. Let's go to Martin, who's calling from Sinclair, Maine. Martin, what did you think about the president's legal team's opening statements?
Thank you for taking my call. I thought the president's counsel came up short on Saturday with their 2 hours. I have a hard time to believe that they'll be successful this coming week, and that they spent an exorbitant amount of time complaining about the House managers, using approximately 22 hours. It had been allocated 24 hours, so I don't know why the president's counsel would find fault with that. And I do believe that witnesses are necessary. I wish the Senate would invite them in. And I wish that Senator Collins would follow the good lead of a Senator Margaret Chase Smith and what her conscience would do in this matter, as well as former Senator Cohen, Bill Cohen, and I think she should listen, she could, to what Senator McCain might do, all Republican senators.
Yeah.
But I think those three people would do in this instance.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for your call. That's Martin from Sinclair, Maine. Let's go now to Robert, who's calling from Thompson, Pennsylvania. Robert, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. On both the opening day of the impeachment hearing and on the opening day of the Senate's testimony, lawyer Cipollone said more or less the same thing, that the whole process was ridiculous and unfair because Republicans were iced out of participating in the House. And then he said the same thing, I believe it was Saturday, or maybe Friday. At any rate, lawyer, and he stood before the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, as well as millions on TV. And he knows that's a lie, because there are minutes that give the names of the Republicans that were there, and the comments, the questions that they ask.
In the Intelligence Committee hearings, for example. Well, Robert, thank you so much for that call. Anita Kumar, do you want to respond to Robert?
Yeah, I mean, that is just one of the things that they're going to say. He's right. They did say that. They will continue to say that. They have said that outside the trial. I do think that today, starting at 1, when the White House team is back, when the president's legal team is back, they're going to go into more detail. Well, at least that's what a lot of Republican senators hope they'll do. My colleagues had a story last week saying that the Republicans there want to hear more of the details, the facts of the actual Ukraine allegations, as opposed to just about the process. So, you know, hopefully today they will go through some of that and talk about why they think the president didn't do this. One thing that they did say, and they have said, is that the House side just cherry-picked what they wanted to put out there. They put the evidence out there or the information out there that shows, makes it look like the president didn't do this, but there's actually more to the story. So hopefully they'll explain that today.
Well, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico, and Lisa Desjardins, she comes with the Capitol for PBS's NewsHour. Hang on, both of you, for just a second. Time for our quick break. We are talking about another big week ahead in the news. When we come back, we'll also touch on some international news, including the spread of coronavirus as well. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're trying to wrap our heads around what's going to be certainly another big week in the news. And I'm joined today by Anita Kumar. She's White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. And Lisa Desjardins joins us. She covers the Capitol for PBS's NewsHour. And I feel like, Lisa, in a sense, we're playing a game of where's Lisa Desjardins right now? have you made it into the Capitol?
Yes, I am. I'm walking into the Capitol right now. Just went through security.
Okay, good. So
yes.
if you need to break away to actually cover.
No, I'm great. Great.
Yeah, just wave to a senator as they walk by. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about yet another revelation that happened this weekend and the impact it might have in the coming week. And that is a tape that was released by the lawyer for Lev Parnas. And it's a tape that involves discussion in one evening in 2018, and it captures President Trump talking with some donors and talking about how his desire for the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Maria Yovanovitch, to be removed. And here's a moment from that tape.
The biggest problem there, I think, where we need to start is we got to get rid of the ambassador. She's still left over from the Clinton administration.
Were the ambassador, were Ukraine?
Yeah, and she's basically walking around telling everybody, wait, he's going to get impeached, just wait. I mean,
really?
It's incredible. It's
she'll be gone tomorrow.
What's your name?
I don't remember his name.
But
name
back.
So one of the things that will be, now that we have a secretary state that's been this morning.
Get rid of her.
Hooray. One of the first
okay,
things
get her out tomorrow. I don't care. Get her out tomorrow. Take her out. Okay?
Excellent.
Do it.
So, Anita Kumar, it's hard to tell who those other voices are in that tape, but what's the significance of this tape?
Well, if you'll remember during the House, testimony and hearings, this is something that had come up that the president wanted to get rid of the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine because she wasn't in favor of having these investigations that the president wanted. The president has said many things about her, including that she wouldn't put up the photographs of the president in the, in her office. So there's been sort of a back and forth. But when she testified in front of the House, she said she felt sort of threatened. She was pushed out. She was told to immediately get on a plane and go home. And she basically was fired. So, the administration and the president has said, she's exaggerating sort of what happened. But he's also said he's allowed to, which he's correct on this, mm-hmm. allowed to have any ambassador he wants. Obviously, presidents nominate the ambassadors. They're confirmed by the Senate. So he's allowed to do that. So she was a very compelling witness for the House. So this just bolsters her, her story, what she said. The other thing, of course, is that you can't really see on this tape. It's more audio than visual. But there's the two now indicted associates, former business associates of the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, are there in this very small gathering. So it also bolsters the fact that, the president says he doesn't know these people. There they are in a small gathering that appears to be at the Trump Hotel in Washington, where he's talking to them about Ukraine. So, I mean, that does also bolster that. Lev Parnas, that's one of the associates, his story, which is the president was, directing this. We know him. He knew us. We were working for him, essentially. And so it really does bolster his statement that he's given in these last couple weeks.
Well, let's go to another caller. Let's go to Dwayne, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Dwayne, you're on the air.
Hi. I just think that this idea that the Ukrainian aid being tied to the investigations is a big deal. I don't see where that's a problem because if the President of the United States thinks there's corruption going on in Ukraine and we're giving them hundreds of millions of dollars and we just got a new president in Ukraine elected and they don't know what kind of guy he is, if he's corrupt or not. Also, we don't know if the Bidens were engaged in corruption or not. It's a legitimate question. When Joe Biden gets on national TV or whatever on a recording and says, listen, we're holding up $1 billion of aid to Ukraine unless they fire this prosecutor who allegedly is investigating Burisma, where his son works. So, I mean, that's a legitimate question. For people to make such a big deal out of this, that he held up this aid to a country that's been corrupt, we're giving them hundreds of millions of dollars. And they make an impeachable offense out of him holding up. Even if he did hold it up because of that reason, there's nothing wrong with it. He's got the right to do it.
Well, Dwayne, thank you so much for that call. Lisa Desjardins, Dwayne said a lot there. But one point I did want to make is I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when Vice President Joe Biden was speaking up about that former Ukrainian prosecutor, it's because the U.S. government at that time believed that prosecutor was not actually investigating corruption as much as possible.
That's correct. I mean, it's hard to know for certain because Ukraine is a place that is run at the time and to some degree still now run by oligarchs who have multiple motivations. But that's right. What Vice President Biden was doing was sort of pushing for more investigations into corruption. Some believe that could have led to closer looks at Burisma and more in-depth looks at Burisma. But, we won't know. We don't know for sure because that prosecutor was, in fact, left office
I think one other thing I want to raise up about the Lev Parnas call, that Anita was talking about, this also has implications for Bolton's testimony potentially. The idea that Bolton saw the motivation for removing Ivanovich as purely political, that perhaps Giuliani was doing, this is in the New York Times story and others, that Giuliani might have had personal motivations for his clients who did not want Ivanovich looking at them, who might have had, you know, some corruption investigations they were facing that she was pushing for. So if you follow that logic, and if Bolton was aware of sort of real personal benefit to removing Ivanovich, then that is corrupt motive by Giuliani and potentially by this president. And that's also something very significant in this trial. Again, Bolton hasn't testified, but this is why Democrats want him to, these kinds of questions. Mm.
Well, Anita Kumar, just one last question for you before we transition to world news here. Is there what are the things that you're really going to be keeping your eye on as they develop over the week?
Well, I think this Bolton information has sort of changed things. But I mean, obviously, the key decision this week is whether the Senate will have witnesses. And why that's so important is it could change, they could hear witnesses, and it might change some senators' minds on how they might vote. It will prolong the trial, so it could go on for weeks if they decide to have witnesses. And it also could be very embarrassing and problematic for the president. He wants a quick acquittal. He wants to get on the campaign trail. He wants to continue on with other things that he's doing. So how much of a problem will this be? Obviously, it's impeachment, so it is a problem. But witnesses could make it put it in a whole different way, put it in a different light.
Well, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico, it was always great to have you, Anita. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
And Lisa Desjardins, she covers the Capitol for PBS's NewsHour, joining us from the Capitol building today. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming to work with me.
Okay. Well, let's shift gears here and take a look at some major news from around the world coming up this week. First and foremost, a lot of attention, deservedly so, on the spread of coronavirus. So here's a press conference at Hong Kong University just today, and Professor Gabriel Lang has warned that the number of patients showing symptoms of the coronavirus could double in just 6 days if left unchecked, and he's urged the international community for drastic measures.
If we wish and desire to change the course of those epidemic curves that I presented, then we are looking at substantial, draconian measures limiting population mobility that should be taken sooner rather than later. It includes cancellation of mass gatherings, school closures, instituting work from home arrangements within population, but also between population clusters.
So that is Professor Gabriel Lang at Hong Kong University today. Now, there have been more than 40 confirmed cases of coronavirus in China. The virus is being found to be much more contagious than originally thought. So joining us now with more is Anton LaGuardia, joining us from London. He's the editor for the Economist magazine's online content. Anton, welcome to you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So tell us a little bit more about the response and the international community's response now to increasing concerns over coronavirus.
Well, to begin with, the numbers keep changing, and we're now at about 80 dead and something approaching 3,000 who have or known to have been infected, and the cases are obviously concentrated in China, but also outside China, and you know, not least with some infections reported in the United States. So there's really two broad sets of questions. One is, you know, how deadly is it, how infectious is it, and how quickly can it spread? And I think for that we need more information. You know, the epidemiological curves that the expert whose clip you had on, you know, all start roughly in the same place, but they can sort of have different lines, and it's still very hard to say which way and how, you know, how many people will be affected. But nevertheless, caution is in order, and China has enacted, you know, draconian measures to try and contain the spread of this. The second thing is a political, which is that, you know, an authoritarian state like China has been able to do things that, you know, few democratic countries could, you know, confining tens of millions of people to their cities and keep them off the streets, stopping public transport links, and also, you know, building hospitals, you know, within days to try and create isolation units. But it's also, I think, you know, a dangerous moment for the communist leadership because it's the first crisis that Xi Jinping has really faced on the domestic front. And, you know, how he responds to it is going to be very telling of how sensitive they think this is going to be domestically.
Mm. It's an interesting balance to have to strike because, of course, I mean, there is legitimate concern about coronavirus. And as you mentioned, there have been some draconian measures already taken. The restriction of travel on some 30 million people in at least 11 cities in China and perhaps indefinite restrictions on travel for now. So we'll keep our eye on what's happening with coronavirus. But Anton, let's also move to another event, a major event that's happening this week. In fact, today in world news, where U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to disclose his Middle East peace plan to Israeli leaders today, as I mentioned. So talk about that a little bit. What's the significance there?
Well, I mean, this has been, you know, Donald Trump talked about wanting to negotiate the ultimate deal, which was peace between Israel and the Palestinians. We've been waiting for 3 years, and now he's about to unveil his plan to the Israeli Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, and the Israeli opposition leader, Benny Gantz. What's in it precisely, we don't know, but we assume that it's a deal that will be favorable to Israel, certainly, and probably favorable to Bibi Netanyahu personally. To the point where Benny Gantz had for a long time said he didn't want it to be unveiled before the Israeli election, which takes place in March, and has only reluctantly agreed to go to Washington to hear the details and will head straight back to Israel to continue the election campaign. The prime minister says this is a historic moment. He's hoping for wonderful news. Supporters are saying this is everything we could ever have hoped for. So the assumption is that it will give a green light to annexation of parts of the occupied West Bank, particularly what they call the Jordan Valley and possibly areas around Jerusalem. It should be said that the Palestinians were not involved in the negotiation. Right. They've more or less cut off contact with the administration, and they've already rejected it.
Right. I mean, they're calling it an attempt to finish off the Palestinian cause. So we've just got a couple of minutes left to go here, Anton. We're trying to cram a lot of global news into just a few minutes. But come 11 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time on Friday, Brexit will have finally arrived. Is it actually going to happen, Anton?
Well, I mean, the Britain's withdrawal from the European Union will happen. Life will not change very much because there will be a year-long transition period, but Britain will lose its seat at the top table, and its members of the European Parliament will be heading home, and they're packing up their boxes. And there is still a great deal of uncertainty of what the future relationship will look like. They have to negotiate a big trade deal with the Europeans. They're hoping to negotiate a trade deal with the United States. And the nature of both those agreements is still uncertain. And moreover, Britain has to decide what its place in the world is going to be. And it has to decide what the nature of the relationship between the constituent elements of the United Kingdom will be. Scotland voted against Brexit, but it's happening against its will. Northern Ireland voted against it, and there's a whole question of what the Irish border is going to look like. So there's an awful lot of uncertainty that still surrounds this. And the government would like to talk about other subjects, but I fear it will be brought back to this question certainly by the end of the year when big decisions will have to be taken.
Well, Anton, though, just to be clear, over the many years that this Brexit issue has been going on, there had been talk about when the UK formally withdraws from the European Union, would there be any sort of day zero impacts? I mean, we were hearing, you know, scary scenarios of food shortages, medicine shortages, a backup of miles and miles and miles and miles of trucks at Dover, for example, because of the lack of a customs union. None of that on the horizon?
That is a possibility at the end of the year. Essentially, they've agreed to carry on as they are for the rest of the year. That possibility that you describe was a so-called no-deal Brexit. If Britain and the EU didn't reach an agreement on the terms of the withdrawal and the transition period, you would have had that sort of chaotic scenario. Mm-hmm. They did reach an agreement at the end of last year, so there will be no chaos at the borders at the end of this weekend, although, you know, there may be some changes here and there as people are uncertain about how things will work out. But the possibility of a no-deal scenario, a no-deal Brexit, is still looming over everybody unless they reach an agreement. And that is because the Prime Minister has said he wants a trade deal with the Europeans at the end of the year, come what may.
Well,
so it is possible they won't get it.
It is still possible they won't get it. Wow. Well, Anton LaGuardia, editor for The Economist magazine's online content, joining us from London. Anton, thank you so very much.
Nice to talk to you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.